Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elizabeth Colbert, who has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1999. Her three-part series on global warming, The Climate of Man, won the 2006 National Magazine Award for Public Interest, the 2005 American Association for the Advancement of Sciences Journalism Award, and the 2006 National Academy's Communication Award. She is the author of The Prophet of Love and Other Tales of Power and Deceit, and Field Notes from a Catastrophe, and her latest book just out is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Colbert.
Thanks for having me.
And we happen to be talking on the same day that the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change have issued their report, which is quite alarming, of course, and the headline is that the worst is yet to come. But the message from this, the IPCC, seems to be that the world has to adapt and the world has to mitigate. How about prevent? Have we passed the point where we can't prevent?
I'm afraid we have passed the point where we can't prevent some additional climate change. I mean, the climate has already changed. We've probably increased average global temperatures by around, let's say, a degree Fahrenheit, roughly. And what people really need to understand about climate change is that there's a lot of inertia in the climate system. And so there's a lot of scientists speak about warming that's already in the pipeline. And that is quite probably another, let's say, degree or so. So and that is, you know, sort of baked into the system. How's that? And we're not going to prevent that. What we do really need to try to prevent is going beyond that. You, I'm sure many of your listeners have heard about this idea that we really need to try to limit climate warming to 2 degrees Celsius or less. That's roughly 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. We may still have time to do that, but only if we act really, really dramatically and really, really quickly. We seem to be sort of blowing past that threshold pretty quickly.
So would the idea that crop yields, again, which are already going down, will drop precipitously, there'll be food shortages, already fish catches in the tropics are down between 40 and 60%. They're down, but they're projected to fall by between 40 and 60%. At what point does that get our attention, do you think?
Well, you know, that that is the question of our time, isn't it? I mean, there have certainly been a number of really serious weather-related disasters that quite probably have a climate change component. There have been, you know, we're having a very serious drought in the American Southwest, in California, and from where we get a lot of our food, as you Californians certainly know, we're having a very serious drought. In Australia, there's been terrible drought and terrible, terrible heat waves during this past summer, their summer. And so we keep getting all of these signals. The Arctic ice cap is melting away. The Arctic ice cap has been around, you know, for millions of years. And we don't seem to be able to really respond to that in any sort of appropriate way. So I honestly don't know what it's going to take.
Well, it's extraordinary to think that, Elizabeth Colbert, that so much of our political debate in this country is still mired in denial. I understand why denial is appealing. I guess that was the notion that former Vice President Al Gore had in the title of his film, The Inconvenient Truth. It is inconvenient, but it's as long as we debate whether or not it's real or not, that seems to be a deliberate delaying tactic. And clearly we're running out of time, if not having run out of time. So what is your sense of how we can break that cycle of denial, or at least that constituency of denial?
You know, I wish I had the answer to that. I've spent, you know, really the last 10 years writing about this topic. I have written this story every way I can think of to to write about it, to try to get people's attention, to try to, as you say, break through that, you know, wall or film of denial that prevents us from moving forward. And I don't know what the answer is. You know, I don't, it's not like I took it, you know, my work in and of itself to do that, but lots and lots of people have been working on this. And so far, you know, it hasn't been successful. I think more and more people are aware of it and are concerned, but it hasn't been enough to raise this to the level where our politics have changed. And I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that question is. I wish I had an answer for you.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Colbert, who has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1999. Her three-part series on global warming, the climate of man, won the 2006 National Magazine Award for Public Interest, the 2005 American Association for the Advancement of Science's Journalism Award, and the 2006 National Academy's Communication Award. She's the author of The Prophet of Love and Other Tales of Power and Deceit and Field Notes from a Catastrophe. And her latest book just out is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. So there have been, of course, associated with what we're talking about, Elizabeth Colbert, the so-called climate walls. Michael Mann, climatologist, has been under assault. One of the main engines of denial, if you will, is Fox News. And it's worth noting that the second biggest investor in News Corp, the family-owned or the family-controlled company by Rupert Murdoch and his family, after the family, the second biggest investors are the Kingdom Fund, which is the Saudi Arabian monarchy. So you understand where they're coming from. But my sense is that we appear to be reaching a point where the notion of national patriotism is becoming archaic, and that we really need to form a kind of global patriotism. And if we do have the climate wars between reality and the deniers, at a certain point, you know, we have to start calling people war criminals.
Well, that suggestion, you know, has been made that this is, you know, a real getting to the point of as you say, sort of constituting, you know, crimes against humanity, preventing any kind of action to avert a potential, you know, crisis that will have really serious ramifications, probably especially for those countries and peoples, you know, who have contributed least to the problem. And I think there's a very, you know, very strong ethical case. I'm not sure I'd get to the level of war crimes, but there's a very strong case to be made, you know, that the behavior that is blocking action and is disseminating, people are disseminating, you know, misinformation, that this is beyond, you know, stupid and sort of politically beyond the bounds of what's politically acceptable, even in a society that accepts a lot of falsehoods as part of its political discourse, that this is really getting to a level of you know, behavior that ethically can't be tolerated. Now, what you do when you decide, okay, ethically this can't be tolerated, that, you know, that unfortunately gets us back to the question of how do you break through?
Well, one of the things that's pretty clear in our culture is that we admire men and women in uniform, and politicians always pay homage to our fighting men and women. Well, it turns out that the Pentagon are actually at the cutting edge of the recognition that climate change is a reality. So, by the way, is CIA and other intelligence agencies. The Australian Intelligence Agency, for example, believe that climate change is the number one security threat to Australia. So would that be helpful? Because clearly, as this new report from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change indicates, the combination of climate change with poverty that already exists and a shaky global economy could lead to war and drive people to leave their homes.
Yes, I mean, I think you raise a really good point, and there have been several reports, you know, that have gotten some press about various as you say, defense departments and people whose job it is to look into the security threats of the future have identified climate change as very high up there on the list of destabilizing forces in the globe and potential sources of conflict going forward. And I think it's a good point that you raise that, you know, those people are often, not associated, let's just say, with the most liberal politics, and that they would be very good way to sort of maybe bridge or break through this ideological divide. That hasn't happened either yet. I don't know whether that's because they haven't made it a priority. It would be a really interesting question if some of the, you know, really top people at the Pentagon said, okay, we take this on to go talk to the top, you know, the committee chairman of the relevant committees, that something needs to be done about this because it's a security threat. I would really like to hear those conversations. I unfortunately suspect they haven't taken place.
So in terms of your new book, Elizabeth Colbert, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, I've spoken before to Peter Ward, a paleontologist, who's published widely on biodiversity and the fossil record and is an expert on mass extinction, which he wrote about in Under a Green Sky, pointing out that all but one of the major extinction events in history, which the five and, until you brought up the sixth, have been brought on by climate change. So give us a sense of this sixth extinction then in terms of the record. Can you sort of put it in that context?
Well, the five previous mass extinctions, which are scattered throughout the fossil record at very great distance from us, the most recent of those five is 66 million years ago. It's sort of the most famous, as it were, and most the one that did in the dinosaurs, and which was a pretty broad scientific consensus that was caused by an asteroid impact. And what unites the previous five, I think, more than climate change, to be honest, is that there were moments of when the world changed very rapidly, too rapidly for many, many species to adapt. And that is what unites it with the sixth extinction, which is, you know, happening or on the verge of happening right now, which is that we are changing the world very, very rapidly. Climate change is just one of the ways, it turns out, in which we're changing the world very, very rapidly.
So you have, of course, one of the bitter ironies about this is that so many of the countries, I have a friend, Cleo Pascal, who works with these island nations that are going under, and her big complaint is that they just don't have a lot of power. They have seats in the General Assembly, but yeah, Nobody much cares about them. Bangladesh, which is really going to be impacted, they have perennial problems. So is that a problem? Is that, I suppose, though, on the other side of the coin, I guess you could argue that wealthy people in Florida who are going to, you know, suddenly be inundated by the ocean, maybe they balance it out. But is that one of the ironies, that the constituency for those first affected doesn't have political clout in the global context?
I think that is one of the tragic ironies. That gets to the point that those are going to be, you know, quite possibly most severely affected. Well, first of all, they're the people who are already living on the edge and don't take much to get pushed over the edge. But it's just true that the countries, very, very poor countries, have contributed relatively little to the problem, but they're going to, in many cases, for whatever reason, because of geography, in many cases, going to get hammered. And they're also going to get hammered because they do lack, you know, the finances to, you know, certain adaptive technologies are going to help. The Dutch have been living below sea level for centuries, as it were. They're a very rich country. Maybe they will be able to deal with significant sea level rise that's coming, but that doesn't mean that many other countries will. So, you know, they're getting hit from all sides, sort of, and Bangladesh is sort of maybe becoming, you know, and low-lying island nations, which are already preparing, to decamp, you know, and bought land on Fiji, for example, which is all in itself being severely affected by climate change. But I also do want to raise the point. I mean, I don't think anyone should feel, and I think California's experience, you know, increasingly is bringing this home to people in the U.S. and in the industrialized world. No one is immune. That is one of the lessons of today's report. No one is going to escape this unaffected. Now, you know, as I say, the closer you are to the edge, the easier it is to push you over the edge. But, you know, when global food supplies grow short, you know, everyone on some level suffers.
Well, Elizabeth Colbert, I had some friends up nearby here in Santa Barbara who tried to come up with a form of activism that was very, I think, very educational, which was to paint a little kind of logo of, you know, the rippling waves of the ocean, just a little blue icon on buildings throughout Santa Barbara that indicate where the sea level will be in X number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what happened? The city closed them down because it was bad for tourism.
Right, right. It's very bad for real estate. I mean, a colleague, a friend of mine, actually wrote a piece about, you know, the prognosis for Miami, which, as you suggested, is really quite bad, both because of sea level rise and because of the way that the city is constructed on limestone makes it very, very difficult to protect it from sea level rise. And, you know, the local Chamber of Commerce sort of went berserk, went into overdrive about trying to deny that this is the case. But, you know, certain basic facts, unfortunately, are facts. Now, they are facts that can be, you know, conveniently ignored until the waves are lapping, you know, at that elevation. But they can't be ignored forever. And, you know, the whole point of going through these exercises of the IPCC reports is to try to get people to take action before, you know, really dreadful things happen. And this gets back to the fact that there's a lag in the system. What you see happening right now is not, in effect, the future is already now. We've already guaranteed certain outcomes. We've already guaranteed a fair amount of sea level rise. So we need to, and that gets back to the point that you made earlier, we need to both be aware of that and be planning for that, and we need to try to prevent those things for which no planning is possible, you know, things that are just beyond the scope of our being able to cope with them.
So, Elizabeth Colbert, is there a connection then between modern capitalism where, you know, the CEOs of big corporations can only think about the next quarter? There's a case, for example, of Verizon. They had a CEO that actually was a bit of a visionary, and he decided to opt to put fiber cable down, Fios it's called. But Wall Street canned him because the payoff was too many quarters in the future. You know, they were only interested in a quick buck, and he got fired. And then the irony is, of course, Fios is the biggest profit generator in Verizon. But that's how our capitalism works. And is that, I mean, my thought is that if you've got oil companies and the Koch brothers on one side who are pushing global warming denial for their own mendacity and profit, what about insurance companies, people like that who are going to take a bath? Can you organize a corporate constituency to fight the deniers?
You know, I think that is increasingly happening, that you do see a growing, you know, constituency among people who have a financial stake in a different kind of future. But I think that there's just, the problem is with all political problems too, is that inertia is all, you know, the tie goes to the side that just wants to keep doing things as we are, because that's what everyone is most comfortable with, you know. And this notion that Americans want change, which we say every 4 years, is, I think, you know, pretty patently untrue. We actually don't want change. Now, the problem is we're going to get change, whether we want it or not, and the question is, you know, to what extent are we going to do that in a conscious way, and to what extent are we just going to let the future sort of come at us? So I don't know. I really don't know if we have enough sort of far-sighted corporate leaders to put together, you know, any kind of really strong political movement. Once again, these are questions that we're going to find out. You know, we're in the process of finding that out.
Well, the Obama White House says it's taking this new UN report as a call of action. And Secretary of State John Kerry is saying the costs of inaction are catastrophic. What's your sense of our political leadership on this issue?
Well, I think the Obama administration does want to, you know, get something done before it leaves office, something significant. They've sort of given up on the legislative process, however, and you can't really blame them because it's pretty clear that that's not going to yield anything. So they're trying to take executive actions that would make some sort of difference, and that includes, for example, we should see regulations governing existing power plants and their carbon dioxide output that could have pretty dramatic impact on how power is generated in this country. Those will be litigated. The administration has waited till, you know, sort of the last possible moment that they could conceivably get done before they leave office. So, you know, you can't say that they've taken the most far-sighted and responsible course here. But, you know, given that they've sort of squandered a lot of time, they are trying to make a push towards the end of the administration to try to get something done.
Well, just in closing, Elizabeth Colbert, Hillary Clinton recently speaking at the University of Arizona, she told the students, or perhaps agreed with the students, I'm not sure exactly in the context of her remarks, were that this is the defining, global warming is the defining issue of our time, and that this should be the next, in effect, student movement. What did you take from that?
Well, I took two things. I mean, first of all, I completely agree with her. I think young people really need to be aware. As I say, people tend to look at this problem and say, okay, well, it's not so bad right now. We still have time to deal with it. And this point that people really need to understand, as I said, can't stress enough, is that, you know, things are way, way past what you can see today. We've really locked in a lot of the warming for the next, you know, half a century already. So you can't just infer from what's happened this past year, this past week, this past month, to what's going to be happening in the future. So I completely agree with Hillary Clinton that this should be young people's issues. They should be extremely angry about the world that they're being left with, the problem they're being left with, and they should demand change of a very, very dramatic and immediate nature. Now, that being said, I think that both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have sort of taken the same position, which is someone else should build the constituency for this sort of change. And the point that I would make is a responsible political leadership would be building that constituency. So, you know, I don't think that we should absolve them of responsibility.
Well, Elizabeth Colbert, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Colbert, who's been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1999. Her three-part series on global warming, The Climate of Man, won the 2006 National Magazine Award for Public Interest, the 2005 American Association for the Advancement of Science Journalism Award, and the 2006 National Academies Communication Award. She's the author of The Prophet of Love and Other Tales of Power and Deceit and Field Notes from a Catastrophe. Her latest book just out is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.
another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.